Welcome to the Ambulatory Healthcare Today podcast, hosted by the NextGen Advisors. Accelerate your success with insights from a multidisciplinary team of healthcare experts as they discuss an array of topics. These timely discussions can help you better navigate the challenges of running your ambulatory care practice. Here is your host.
Hello, this is Graham Brown, Senior Vice President and Principal with NextGen Advisors. My colleague, Dr. Marty Lustig, and I are joined once again by NextGen's Government Affairs Advisor, Chris Emper, to look at the status and implications of the 21st Century Cures Act. It's been over 5 years since the law's passage, and in 2020, the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology published a final rule to implement many of the law's main provisions. Today, we'll take a look at the Cures Act law, the final rule, and discuss the impacts for both the health IT industry and healthcare providers, which are focused on promoting health data interoperability through a variety of new and or revised programs, mandates, and rules. Welcome, Marty and Chris.
Thanks, Graham.
Okay, Chris, first and foremost, give us maybe a 30-second rundown on what this act is, where it came from, and why it's important for us.
Of course, I'll try within 30 seconds, which is always a challenge for me. But the 21st Century Cures Act was passed into law in December of 2016. It was a bipartisan law when you had about over 90% of members of the House and the Senate from both political parties actually voted for it. The reason why, and if you kind of glean from the title, the 21st Century Cures Act, it primarily had to do with reforming FDA regulatory policies to speed new drugs and devices to market. Also provided a lot of funding for the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, to do research, cancer research, genomic research, precision medicine, all these things that were sort of forward-looking and they thought at the time would bring new cures, more medical innovation to the market. It took a few years for Congress to agree on a bipartisan basis on all these different provisions. But tucked into it, and most relevant to our world, were about 50 to 100 pages of provisions around health IT and specifically trying to advance and improve the interoperability of health data. And this really stemmed from what were some perceived failures of the Meaningful Use EHR incentive program that over the last few years, members of Congress before the law passed heard from physicians and hospitals that were unsatisfied with the interoperability between different EHRs and between patients and physicians. So hence came the Cures Act, and even though the overall main goal of the law was around drugs and devices, what we're most interested in, what most healthcare providers are probably most interested in, is around the interoperability provisions.
Great. Okay, that's very helpful because it's quite a complex piece of legislation, covers a lot of ground. So given that introduction on kind of the political and legislative background, maybe explain for our listeners the role of the Office of the National Coordinator and what they were tasked to undertake over the 5 years that's taken place since the bill was passed until this final rule was issued.
Sure. So within the law, there were various different provisions around interoperability that tasked the HHS Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, or ONC as the acronym is, to write regulations to implement the provisions of the law. So once the law was passed in December of 2016, ONC went to work as a regulatory body to write these rules to actually implement the provisions of the law. And because it was such an expansive law and there were several different provisions that were a little bit complex, it took a few years for them to issue these rules. And for those familiar with the federal rulemaking process, you have to go through a notice of a proposed rulemaking. Then you have a public comment period before you actually get a final rule. And in this case, it took ONC a few years to write the proposed rule. It was released in 2019. And then there was a rather lengthy debate when the public comments came in. And then a final rule was issued in March of 2020. And ironically enough, it was actually scheduled to be released at the HIMSS annual conference to coincide with Health IT's big event and the interoperability rules being something the government wanted to promote. But that was actually the same exact week where we started the COVID sort of shutdowns. And it kind of got lost in the mix. It was intended to be the biggest healthcare news of that week, believe it or not. But obviously COVID kind of took over there. And then the rules have been somewhat lost in the shuffle, I think, over the last 2 years and delayed as a result of COVID. But, you know, that's sort of the background and ONC's role on issuing those rules. I would say there are three most critical parts around focused on interoperability are the rules that impact the EHR certification process, the information blocking rules, which is sort of the opposite of sharing information. It's something that's bad that the government's now going to punish when you're not sharing information. And then the promotion of a trusted exchange framework and common agreement that is intended to help health information networks and national exchanges, HIEs, share information. So those are kind of the three main provisions, I would say, that are wrapped up in this rule and in the process of the last few years as ONC has tried to implement this. And finally, I'll say, as you noted in introduction, finally, a final rule. You know, it took several years, 4 years for ONC to release the final rule after the law was actually passed. So the industry was waiting quite a long time. And then when you have implementation dates or compliance effective dates in the rule that are, you know, 6, 12, 24, and 36 months after the rule went into effect in 2020, this has really turned into a decades-long implementation process around all these interoperability rules. So there's really quite a bit to unpack here.
Mm-hmm. So there is indeed. Maybe let's take these three main elements that you just framed for us one by one. EHR certification updates, that's important for provider groups because many of them still use their EHR vendor for the submission of data for quality payment programs and other government-regulated initiatives and quality tracking. So talk a little bit about what this part of the regulation entails.
Sure. So this is labeled in the law and in the ONC final rule, the Cures Act EHR certification update. And for those who remember, back to our meaningful use EHR incentive program days, there were three stages of the EHR meaningful use incentive program. And the way the program was structured, the EHR companies or EHR vendors or solutions had to certify their products where they demonstrate to the government or a government-sponsored testing entity that their products have certain criteria, whether that's e-prescribing or sharing certain information or having certain data fields in the prior versions, but they had to demonstrate that their software, their EHR, met this criteria. And then once it was certified, the clients, the providers, physician groups, hospitals, would utilize that software to meet the reporting criteria under the different stages. And there were three different stages, three different sets of product functionality or criteria that the EHR companies had to go through to become certified, and three different sets of measures that the providers had to do. Why this is all relevant for the Cures Act is because the Cures Act EHR certification essentially acts as the fourth stage here. Even though the program has ended a few years ago and has been kind of engulfed and morphed into the MIPS and APM parts of the macro quality payment program, where you still have to use a certified EHR and you still have to report on certain measures to participate in these federal government programs, either the MIPS program or an ACO or an APM that wants to get credit on the APM side of the house. But the next level of certification that the Cures Act required is going to be this Cures Act certified EHR. As I mentioned, the law was largely focused around interoperability and the product functionality that is going to be required and what is required currently to become certified under the Cures Act for an EHR vendor to gain that stamp of government approval is largely focused around interoperability, although there are some other provisions. And within interoperability, the heavy focus is on FHIR-based APIs, which is, of course, the next wave of interoperability and standards and something that most have been following the industry, although I'm certainly not an expert in interoperability data standards, think is really going to be a game changer in terms of the ability to share information across different providers and, you know, even amongst patients as well with a patient access portion of the API. So where we're at right now, the certification criteria has been finalized. EHR vendors are beginning to certify their products, and it's rolling out where in 2023 to participate in the federal programs, you will, as a provider, have to be live or using the new Cures Act certified EHR. So even though everyone has long since forgotten and was pretty much not a fan of the meaningful use program, I like to say this is meaningful use stage 4 coming in 2023. The EHR vendors are certifying their products and rolling them out right now. Next year is the action year in terms of implementation for providers using that new software.
Okay, got it. Helpful. Marty, I'd like to bring you in here. We think about provider offices, you know, submitting this data. It makes them eligible for some of these alternative payment programs. Talk a little bit about the importance of these alternative payment programs to providers. What's the impact to their bottom line?
Yes, so I would go back to Chris's comment on meaningful use, because in many ways, meaningful use was the driving force that kind of pushed the provider community over the hump of moving from paper to electronic health records in their offices. It was set up initially as financial incentives. If you got your EHR, of course, it had, as Chris pointed out, it has to be certified, but if you implemented your EHR, you got significant financial incentives from Medicare. And then if you didn't do it quickly enough, you could get penalties for not doing it in the out years. And subsequent programs for Medicare have been built on that foundation. So it really played a major role in driving the more rapid transition to electronic health records for providers. But as important was the downstream impact that it also has had on commercial payers. So that if you look at the changes that Medicare drove with their programs, the commercial payers jumped on board as well. So alternative payment models, both in commercial products and in managed Medicare and managed Medicaid that the commercial payers are administering, are all built on the foundation that Medicare started. So these changes in regulations have huge implications for providers, because ultimately it impacts the way they're paid and the way they're going to be paid for all of their patient care.
Yeah. So lots in the technical details here in terms of practical impact. Chris, let's talk about this next part of the rule around information blocking. What's the goal of this provision? And talk about what some, I think, feared this would mean at the practical level. Because as I understood it, there was a fair bit of backlash and controversy in the past year, past few months, around how this provision was to be implemented.
Absolutely. And what a term, information blocking, as a new part of our healthcare lexicon here. So this provision in the law, if you think about the certification provisions as essentially enabling technology that can enable interoperability with the APIs and the ability to exchange data, that was something that they wanted the EHR vendors to provide to the providers, physicians and hospitals, so that they could exchange data. Once they had that data, they went the next step further and said, if you're not using that technology to share data, when you have an appropriate request where, you know, HIPAA privacy and security rules are satisfied, and you have either a patient or a provider who's requesting some portion or the entire health record to be shared, and you have either an EHR vendor, a health information exchange or network, or a provider, a hospital, physician group, or any clinician, if you do not share that record, you could be guilty or, you know, charged with information blocking, which is a new civil infraction under the Federal Code of Regulation. So you won't go to prison from information blocking, but you could be subject to some penalties. You know, think of HIPAA as a similar regulatory scheme here. And again, it's brand new. And I think looking back to what HIPAA did in healthcare and really brought heightened awareness around the ability to lock down and protect data, you know, from a privacy and security standpoint, this information blocking rules in some ways 25 years later is doing the opposite and is saying, we want you to protect that, but not in all instances. And when you have an approved method of data exchange with another provider or patient, you need to share it. So in the ONC rule, they went into exhausting detail and length to propose exactly what these rules mean. For the purposes of this discussion, I will spare you all of those details because it's quite lengthy, quite complex. A lot of lawyers involved, a lot of regulators involved, a lot of details. But essentially, unless it's reasonable or necessary to not share the information for a list of reasons that they provided and some examples in the rule, again, you have to share it if it's an approved request from a patient or provider. But as you mentioned, the most probably controversial aspect of the rule is actually not between sharing between a hospital and a physician or one EHR vendor and another. It's between physicians and their patients, and specifically around the release of lab results. So these rules promulgated that if a patient has requested their lab results to be released through a patient portal, electronically through a portal, that a physician cannot suppress the delivery of those results, which had been the way a lot of these test results had been delivered over the last few years, had been set up, where the provider orders the test, the patient takes the test, the provider gets the test results electronically, and then either will send a note with the results to the patient explaining what happened through the patient portal, or pick up the phone and call the patient to deliver those results. As a result of the information blocking rules, the provider no longer has that option. And if the patient has requested the delivery of the results electronically, they immediately have to be sent to the portal for the patient to see when the provider gets them as well. So in many instances with, you know, I would say sort of everything serious, but in a non-serious diagnosis or lab result, this wouldn't be a problem. But when you think about some potentially real serious news and the difficulty that patients have assessing healthcare test results and what this lab means, you know, how many times I'm sure for Dr. Lustig, he's seen a patient who said, oh my God, this test result is negative. That's bad. Or this is, you know, it's positive. That's, you know, not even being able to interpret from that aspect what it means. So I think that over the last few months has been highly controversial. The medical societies, physician side societies have pushed back and asked for some reprieve from ONC around this part of the rule. As it stands now, that has not happened. But that's sort of some background and a little bit of an update on where these rules stand. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'll mention is that the rules were finalized again by ONC in 2020. The effective date was April 5th of 2021, but they're in effect now, but essentially not being enforced because we're still waiting on an enforcement rule from the HHS Office of the Inspector General to actually say how they're going to enforce and assess penalties. So kind of in that in-between phase where we know what the rules are, they're technically in effect, but not enforced.
It feels a little bit like the meeting or the intersection of the centrality of the doctor-patient relationship and how technology has just become so integrated in our day-to-day lives. Marty, talk a little bit from your perspective. Is this concern around releasing results to patients, you know, a real issue or a bit of a red herring?
So I would say that in my high level response is that it's a bit of a red herring. A similar example in pediatrics, which is my background, would be a mother who comes in and raises concerns about the father being abusive, physically abusive to the child. And the fear that a pediatrician would have that if the father had access to that information, they might take it out on the child or the mother. But as Chris mentioned, there are protections in the rule as stated that allow a provider to block information if they feel that it's potentially harmful to the patient. It'll be interesting to see how that particular regulation plays out in the context of these lab results issues. Mm-hmm. But to me, the more interesting part of this is, you know, there was a movement that started over a decade ago in Boston with what were called open notes that has now spread across the country, where providers are regularly sharing their entire progress note with patients as soon as it's completed. It's actually moved beyond that to something called shared notes, where patients actually have the opportunity to put in their own comments, edits, and additions to the physician's note, and they both sign off on the notes. And the most interesting part of this is that a fair amount of research has been done in this space, and providers in surveys are overly concerned about the risks to their patients, the risks to their patients emotionally, and the risks to them from a liability perspective of having this completely transparent information sharing with their patients. And yet the reality as it's played out has shown that it actually reduces liability for providers, that patients have access, that it doesn't create increased work for them to go back and interact with patients over and over again about what's in the note or not in the note. And in fact, patients actually end up often improving the quality of the notes by adding their own comments. And they also remove liability for the physician by correcting mistakes right after the note is written, rather than arguing in court 2 years later that that's not what was said. Mm-hmm. So it's it's actually fascinating how the reality is played out compared to the perceptions of the providers. And to me, that work in the open note space is very encouraging, that these issues that physicians are concerned about will get worked through, and that it actually ultimately will improve care.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting concern. You can see how it's problematic in some aspects, and then that it would be the natural thing to do in other ways, in terms of, you know, it's the patient's information. They should have access and understand what's been documented about them and about their health situation. Chris, the third component here of the final rule I think worth discussing is the attempt to get to kind of a really comprehensive national level health data framework. And of course, there's another new fancy acronym that accompanies this, which is TEFCA. Walk us through TEFCA, what it means, and give us a little bit of an explanation around this element, if you could.
Sure. So TEFCA is the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. So this came from the Cures Act and was essentially the provision that was asked for by members of Congress who kept hearing as they were playing around with and, you know, discussing and deliberating upon what to do about interoperability, that we have different national networks of health data exchange. We have Commonwealth, we have Care Quality, we have some strong state and regional HIEs, but they don't share information with each other. So how do we make that happen? Information blocking was one way they did this. The TEFCA was a way of basically setting up a voluntary, so this is a non-regulatory program. It's a voluntary set of requirements that HIEs or national networks can choose to sign on to, whereby if they do, it'll enable them to share information. So the Trusted Exchange Framework is one document produced by ONC that details some different principles and standards that they can use to share information. And then the Common Agreement is actually a contract that they can choose to sign onto, which would be binding in some ways upon those HIEs or networks who signed onto it, but would allow them to share information. And it's run by an outside third party. A government contract was awarded, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. Where TEFCA is in terms of implementation, like the other provisions, it's kind of ongoing right now. It has not gone live, but the final TEFCA document, after it went through a proposed form and public comment, was issued in January of 2022, and it's being implemented through the third-party government contractor right now. And for those entities that sign up for it, it should be live in terms of delivering operational data exchange amongst participants later this year. And whether or not this becomes a huge development and something that leads to nationwide interoperability, or just one more government-sponsored initiative that's, you know, sort of there and an option for folks, I think depends upon the industry participation and various other factors. But that's really what TEFCA is and where it comes from and how it connects to the Cures Act.
Okay. Marty, you've been involved in local health information exchange organizations or regional ones. Talk a little bit about the value of, you know, why would we want to move to a national level of data exchange? What's the value in bringing it up to that national level instead of just the local level where most folks are getting their care in a town, in a city, in a region? Why would we need to share information more broadly?
I think it's a really important question, Graham, because for most people, having nationally available data regarding them as a patient receiving traditional healthcare services is not that important. It may be a nice to have for the subset of our population that are snowbirds or, you know, that can afford to be in different places at different times in the country where their information would be available no matter where they are. But in general, I think the big value of this is actually much more from a public health and a research perspective, particularly if you look in the context of what we've been through with the pandemic, and you look at what Israel has been able to do with a national information infrastructure to very rapidly gather data regarding the impact of vaccination and the new variants that occur. They're leading the world in providing information about what's occurring from a public health perspective in the pandemic. And having an infrastructure like this, like TEFCA, would enable the United States to mimic that kind of public health program, whether it's for the pandemic or a variety of other issues. Mm-hmm. Of course, researchers would love to have a national database, even of unidentified data, to be able to pursue their research interests.
So it really is a future looking element of the Cures Act to really set the stage for a new level of medical discovery and research and knowledge share to go forward. So Chris, help summarize us here as we get ready to close out. Talk a little bit about what you think the final rule accomplished and how's this ball going to move forward in the next little while. You alluded to some ongoing elements of implementation.
Absolutely. Well, right now we're about 5.5 years in from when the law was signed. And as it stands now, there really is not any one major piece of the interoperability provisions of the Cures Act that has fully been fully implemented. So it's very much still a work in progress. And I think where the last 5 years, a lot of the attention has been on the regulators, on ONC writing the final rule and working with the different public-private stakeholder groups to actually figure out how to get the regulations into a place where they can be implemented. The next 5 years, and as I mentioned, each of those different provisions, certification, information blocking, and TEFCA, we're really just on the verge of those being implemented over the course of the next year. I think the next 5 years will be about seeing how that goes. And not only seeing how that goes, but I'm sure as with every government program, there will be refinements and changes in the regulations. And in this sense, there's going to be updates to the standards. A big part of what the Cures Act did was update and make mandatory the use of APIs and certain standards, certainly the FHIR standard. And I think over the next few years, we'll see what the impact of that will be. But I think overall, noting that even though the law passed in 2016, and we probably have not seen the benefits promised at the time around interoperability now because it hasn't been implemented fully, I think certainly the conversation has shifted. And all the topics we just discussed, you know, crossing the whole entire healthcare universe between patients and providers, physicians, hospitals, EHRs, HIEs, national networks, everybody has new requirements and new things they have to do by way of the government in terms of interoperability. So I think it's heading in that direction. It's just a matter of how exactly do we get there? How messy will it be in the interim? And, you know, what the future lies. And I also say this is all government focused, but I'm also a big believer in the power of the private sector. And these rules do allow some flexibility around not only standards, but private sector solutions to some of these interoperability problems. So I think it'll be interesting also to see what happens on that side of things and what problems are solved by the private sector and what problems might in the future be litigated in the information blocking court or amongst the TEFCA board or, you know, in the future iteration of meaningful use stage 5 under certification. So to be determined.
Heaven forbid. Well, that's great. Thank you, Chris and Marty, for this discussion. Certainly a complex topic, but at the same time, really important when we think about just the implications of how we access and who has access and control our sensitive healthcare data. Appreciate you guys joining us today. This is Graham Brown with the Next Gen Advisors. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Ambulatory Healthcare Today. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Ambulatory Healthcare Today podcast, hosted by the Next Gen Advisors. Never miss an episode by subscribing at nextgen.com/podcast. To see a list of products and services tailored for ambulatory care practices, visit nextgen.com.